Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The National Broadcasting Company, in a program sponsored by the Democratic National Committee, brings you an address by the President of the United States, his first major speech in his campaign for re-election. 1,400 delegates of the AFL International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Chauffeurs, Stablemen, and Helpers of America, representing more than 400,000 union members, are now meeting in Washington for their annual convention. And it is to this group and their guests, gathered in Constitution Hall, that he will speak. Daniel J. Tobin, the president of the union, long an intimate friend of the chief executive, and until recently one of his administrative assistants, will present him. Mr. Tobin.
The delegates, be seated. Fellow delegates, visitors and invited guests to this memorable convention of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. You are meeting in the capital of our nation, in perhaps the most dangerous and crucial period in the history of our country, or in the history of the world. The civilization and freedom which our ancestors fought for and suffered for, in order to preserve, is at this particular time battling for its continuance, or perhaps I should say for its very existence. Strong and powerful organizations of labor that flourished successfully a few years ago have been destroyed in many countries throughout the world, and their leadership eliminated. You have come here from every section of the country, and it will be your privilege in a few moments to listen to the man whom I believe stands forth as the greatest influence in this world of today for the continued preservation of that liberty and freedom which we as Americans presently enjoy. In all of my experience with leadership in public and political life, I know of no individual who has so consistently and sincerely and at great sacrifice fought for the betterment of the masses of the people, the working classes of the nation. During all of his public life, he has consistently espoused the battle for the rights and freedom and for a better day for those who give all and receive little. I rejoice as your representative to have this privilege of introducing this great world leader, this human, God-fearing emancipator of the toilers, who in recent years has insisted in striking from the bodies and souls of the workers the shackles which has strangled them and deprived them of their rights and liberties in the past. I present to you President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mr. Tobin, members of the convention, I'm in a sort of a quandary tonight. I don't know whether this is a political speech or not. I don't know because these days, if in a certain period of the year, you refer in any way to things that happened in the days of George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or any other period in the past, including the past 7 years. It's a great question as to whether you are talking American history or politics. And so I throw myself upon your indulgence and the indulgence of the radio companies, who would in the one case be paid and in the other case not be paid. And I throw myself on the indulgence of the American public. I don't know. During these past weeks, in several sections of the country, within an overnight journey of Washington, for I have to stick pretty close, I've been inspecting the progress of our national defense. I've gone through Navy yards and private yards to watch the building of destroyers and submarines and aircraft carriers. I visited aviation units to see our modern fighting planes. I've been in our great gun factories, where I've seen the most modern weapons of all types swiftly being molded into shape. I visited camps where young Americans are receiving training and instruction in the tactics of warfare and the broader tactics of life today. Through all of it, there was the impressive conviction that America is rising to meet the ever-growing need for an adequate physical armed defense of the United States. Tonight, in a very real sense, I feel as I stand here that I'm visiting another type of national defense. National defense, a type equally important in its own way in meeting the needs of the times. Enduring strength to a nation and staying power in an emergency definitely call for an efficient and determined labor force, carrying on the processes of industry and trade. And when I speak of labor force, I very definitely include in that those who toil in their fields, as well as those who toil in business and industry. I think that Teamsters will be the first to assert that farmers labor too. It is one of the characteristics of a free and democratic modern nation that we have free and independent labor unions. In country after country in other lands, labor unions have disappeared as the iron hand of the dictator has taken command. Only in free lands have free labor unions survived. And when trade union workers assemble with freedom and independence in a convention like this, it is proof that an American democracy has remained unimpaired. It is a symbol of our determination to keep it free. Yours is now one of the greatest international labor unions of America. You can remember, however, other days. Days when labor unions were considered almost un-American by some individuals in our land. You can remember when it was rare indeed for an employer even to consider collective bargaining with his workers, when it was the common practice to discharge any worker who joined a union. You can remember when employers sought to meet threatened strikes by demanding that their government, federal or state, call out armed troops. You can remember when many large employers resorted to the un-American practice, still unfortunately followed in some sections of the land, of hiring labor spies and setting up private arsenals to ferret out and destroy members of the Union. The cause of labor has traveled forward since those days over a long road, a road beset with difficulties, difficulties both from within its membership and from without. Your organization is an outstanding example of the progress that has been made. By 1933, it seems almost like ancient history to me, your membership had dropped in that year to 70,000. Within the last 7 years, you have grown to a membership of 500,000. In those same 7 years, organized labor as a whole has become stronger in membership, stronger in influence, and stronger in its capacity to serve the interests of the laboring man and woman and of society in general than at any other time in our whole history. Much of this progress has been due, I like to think, to the one thing that this administration from the very beginning has insisted upon, the assurance to labor of the untrammeled right, not privilege, but right to organize. Yes, the right to bargain collectively with their employer. That principle has now become firmly embedded in the law of the land. It must remain as the foundation of industrial relations for all time. That great principle has the support today not only of organized labor as a whole, but also of hundreds of thousands of decent, practical, forward-looking employers. A decade ago, a minority of employers were willing to accept the principle of collective bargaining, but today, I believe that the majority of employers gladly accept it. And with that foundation, the last 7 years have seen a series of laws enacted to give to labor a fair share. Or perhaps I should say a fairer share, for we haven't gone the length of the road yet. A fairer share of the good life to which free men and women in a free nation are entitled as a matter of right. Fair minimum wages are being established for workers in industry. Decent maximum hours and days of labor have been set to bring about the objective of an American standard of living and recreation. Child labor has been outlawed in practically all factories. A system of employment exchanges has been created. Machinery has been set up and strengthened and successfully used in almost every case for the mediation of labor disputes. Over them all has been created a shelter of social security, a foundation upon which we are trying to build protection from the hazards of old age and unemployment. But you and I know that this progress of the last 7 years has been mighty difficult. It's been beset by obstruction and by bitter propaganda from certain minority groups in the community who had been accustomed for too many years to the exploitation of the great mass of people who worked for them. It was the same type of opposition to which I had become accustomed a great many years ago, during the very beginnings of what has been a certain amount of varied experience, dating back to my first election to the Senate of the State of New York 30 years ago this autumn, continuing through my service for nearly 8 years as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and my service during 4 years as governor of the largest labor-employing state in the Union. You will remember that kind of opposition in the campaign of 4 years ago. 4 years ago, when certain employers, certain politicians, and certain newspapers, all of whom are now active in this campaign, in an effort to mislead and intimidate labor. 4 years ago, they went to the extent of putting untrue electioneering notices in pay envelopes in order to smash the new Social Security Act and to force its repeal by electing its enemies. That kind of opposition comes only too often from those who regularly, for 3 years and 8 months, block labor's welfare, and then for 4 months loudly proclaim that they are labor's true friends. From those, may I put it this way, from those who love the laboring man in November, but forget him in January. In spite of that opposition, the vast majority of our small businessmen have now become convinced that the gains of labor are the gains of the entire interdependent community, and that the welfare of labor is indispensable to the welfare of all. They know now that their best customer is a satisfied, adequately paid worker with a feeling of security against unemployment and against poverty in his old age. We are still, however, quite distant from the objective we seek. The security and the high standard of living for every man, woman, and child that the resources and manpower of America make possible. Our advance has been accomplished with patience and deliberation. That, I think, is the democratic way. That is the road that leads to lasting results. Here in America, we have kept our feet on the ground. Our progress has been steady and sure, and we've not been misled by illusory promises. Events abroad, that's a different story. Events abroad have shown too late the result of the other kind of methods. Promises of swift revolutionary relief, seductive pictures of panaceas, shortcuts to prosperity and plenty, pictured as simple and easy. All of these have led, and I'm talking recent history, they've led to the same cruel disappointment. For these promises, people yielded up their liberties and all that made life dear. In exchange, they have received only the rationing of their news, the rationing of their religion, the rationing of the clothes upon their backs, and the rationing of the bread upon their tables. Our progress must continue to be a steady and deliberate one. We cannot stand still. We cannot slip back. We must look forward to certain definite things in the future. Yes, the near future. For example, the benefits of Social Security today ought to be broadened and extended. Unemployment insurance ought to cover a larger number of workers. Our old age pension system ought to be improved and extended. The amount of the pension ought to be increased. And above all, these pensions must be given in a manner that will respect the dignity of the life of service and labor which our aged citizens have given to the nation they love. Yes, it's my hope that soon the United States will have a national system under which no needy man or woman within our borders will lack a minimum old age pension that will provide adequate food, adequate clothing, and adequate lodging to the end of the road, and without having to go to the poorhouse to get it. And I look forward to a system coupled with that. A system which, in addition to this bare minimum, will enable those who have faithfully toiled in any occupation to build up additional security for their old age that will allow them to live in comfort and in happiness. The people must decide whether to continue the type of government that has fostered the progress to date, or whether to turn it over to those who, by their action, if not always by their word, have shown their fundamental opposition to the main objectives toward which we have worked in the past and to which we are definitely committed for the future. There are some who would not only stop now the progress we are making in social and labor legislation, but would even repeal what has been enacted during the past 7 years on the plea that an adequate national defense requires the repeal. They would seek unlimited hours of labor. They would seek lower wages. They would seek the cancellation of those safeguards for which we have all struggled so long. I still believe, as I did when I said way back on the 28th of May last, we must make sure in all that we do that there is no breakdown or cancellation of any of the great social gains that we've made in these past years. There is nothing in our present emergency to justify a retreat from any of our social objectives, conservation of resources, assistance to agriculture, better housing, and help to the underprivileged. Yes, our mighty national defense effort that we're engaged in today, all of us, against all present and potential threats, that effort cannot be measured alone in terms of mathematical increase in the number of soldiers and sailors and guns and tanks and planes. Behind them all must stand a united people whose spiritual and moral strength has not been sapped through hunger or want or fear or insecurity. The morale of a people is an essential supplement to their guns and planes. I am convinced that a breakdown of existing labor and social legislation would weaken rather than increase our efforts for defense. Continuance of them means the preservation of the efficiency of labor. It means the return to work of several millions who are still unemployed. And the employment of additional workers and the provisions for overtime payments for overtime work will ensure adequate working hours at decent wages to do all that's now necessary in physical defense. We will not overlook the lesson you learned in Europe in past years. At times, we all know that internal obstacles to the growth of labor unions have come in those rare instances where the occasional scoundrel, it's a good word, old-fashioned, the occasional scoundrel has appeared in a position of leadership. Labor unions are not the only organizations that have to suffer innocently for the crimes and the misdeeds of a handful of selfish and guilty members. The rule applies to all organizations, all trades, all professions alike, including the profession of the law, to which I belong. I cannot add to the terms of condemnation which your president, my old friend Dan Tobin, included in his report to your convention, in which he said, "It is indeed pitiful and heartbreaking and seriously depressing to find that amongst our enormous membership, composed of clean men, fathers of families, Americans of the purest type, to find amongst this membership some creatures so bereft of decency and honor as to bring disgrace upon the international union. Labor knows. I don't have to tell labor. Labor knows that there is no room in the labor movement for the racketeer or the strong-arm man. Government, your government, is determined to help labor unions clean their own house of those few persons who've tried to betray them." In this great crisis, in the past year, additional proof has come that organized labor as well as other groups of our citizens, is aware of its own responsibilities. I have called on representatives of labor to serve. I have placed them in responsible positions to take part in the defense work of the government. From the very start, representatives of labor, including your own distinguished president, have shared in formulating and administering the program. I am particularly glad to be able to say that the AFL, the CIO, and the Railroad Brotherhood are all loyally cooperating in this effort with me and with the National Defense Commission and the Army and the Navy. That cooperation in the task of national defense will, I hope, encourage closer and more friendly relations between all of these great labor organizations. I know that America will never be disappointed in its expectation that labor will always continue to do its share of the job that we now face, and do it patriotically and effectively and unselfishly. In our search for national unity as the basis of national defense, it is necessary and it is fair that every human being in the United States contribute his share. This applies both to those who train in the fighting forces and to the great forces of workers behind the lines. It is equally necessary and fair that every dollar of capital in America also contribute its share. Just so long as we continue to call upon men to train for combat and to train for service behind the lines, will we also continue to call upon the industrial plants of the nation for the service that they can give. Capital and industry, as well as labor and agriculture, are responding, and I take it almost for granted that they will continue to respond. The nation, through its elected representatives, not just the president all alone, but through the elected representatives in the House of Representatives and the Senate of the United States, the nation thus represented is now adopting the principle of selective universal training of its young men. On the same principle, no reasonable person can object to giving the government the power to acquire the services of any plant or factory for an adequate compensation if the owner refuses to make its services available to the defense needs of the nation. And you know, this is nothing new in American life. The principle of eminent domain, or eminent use, as I prefer to call it, is as old as democratic government itself. It merely permits government to acquire or to use for a fair and reasonable price any property, anywhere, which is necessary for the proper functioning of the United States. The overwhelming majority of our munitions and other defense requirements are now manufactured, as we all know, by private enterprise under private management. And we are continuing that process. It is only in the rare case, the isolated case, that the owner of a plant will refuse to deal with the government in a fair way. But if and when such a case does arise, the government cannot stand by, helpless in its efforts to arm and defend itself. No business is above government. And government must be empowered to deal adequately with any business that tries to rise above government. In all of these plans for national defense, only those who seek to play upon the fears of the American people discover an attempt to lead us into war. The American people will reject that kind of propaganda of fear, as they have rejected similar types which are occasionally spread forth near election time. They know that against the raging forces loose in the world today, the best defense is the strongest preparedness. Fighting men and equipment in front, and fighting industry and agriculture behind the lines. Weakness in these days is a cordial invitation to attack. That's no longer a theory. It's a proven fact, proved within the past year. I hate war now more than ever. I have one supreme determination, to do all that I can to keep war away from these shores for all time. I stand with my party and outside of my party as president of all the people. On the platform, the wording that was adopted in Chicago less than 2 months ago. It said, we will not participate in foreign wars, and we will not send our army, naval, or air forces to fight in foreign lands outside the Americas, except in case of attack. And so I suggest very humbly, let us have an end to the sort of appeasement that seeks to keep us helpless by playing on fear and by indirect sabotage of all the progress that we are making. Appeasement, incidentally, as I use it, is a polite word for misdirected partisanship. And so, I come near the close. In our efforts for national defense, fine teamwork throughout the nation has been developed. And you, who are teamsters in this great organization, know what that word teamwork means. The continuance of this teamwork after the present emergency is all over, will have consequences of lasting good to the nation as a whole. It will enable us to enjoy an internal security that I hope will transcend anything we have known heretofore. Ours is a great heritage. We are determined with all our effort and all our might to keep it intact. The workers in the factories, the farmers on the land, the businessmen in plants and offices are at last awake to the perils that threaten America. No selfish interest, no personal ambition, yes, no political campaign can sway the majority will of our people of America to make America strong and to keep America free.
Gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States addressing the annual convention of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Chauffeurs, Stablemen, and Helpers. This was the Chief Executive's first major speech in his campaign for re-election and will probably be his principal appeal for labor's support. This program was sponsored by the Democratic National Committee and was broadcast from Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. This is the National Broadcasting Company.